Thank you very much. Thank you, darling. Harry, look at this guy. I'm not going to mess with him, huh?
How you doing,
you
sir?
You look fantastic. Hello.
This is my new baby boy.
Hello.
And that's when he turned everything around. He was losing in the polls.
Yeah.
And then he went and worked at a McDonald's for about 25 minutes.
Man of the people.
And it just turned around from there.
His populist moment. You know what's really interesting is everyone calls him a sociopath and a narcissist, which I think he is. But he's also like a people person. Like every car of people that came up, he had something to say. Like, oh, look at your lovely mom. Look at you. You look beautiful. You're a beautiful person. And the guy pulls up in his like Toyota Corolla. He's like, hey, I won't want to mess with this guy. You
know,
like
a black person, by the way.
It was a black guy. Yeah. But that's the sort of like glad handling bullshit.
That, it was
like,
retail politics in an era when the most important commodity is
the
hamburger, and
the
we are here today with Phil Neal, who recently wrote a two-piece, two essays about the
Double whopper, if you will.
Yeah, about the reign of the burger in world economic relations. They're both in Brooklyn Rail, Quarter Pounds of Flesh. And these were, I presume, written before the election, before we entered the Burger Reich that we're in.
Burger, burger, give me burgers. I want burger, give me burger.
So,
a thousand-year Burger Reich we've all entered in. We're all living inside of it right now. So you anticipated, Phil, the Burger Reich with your double whopper of a Brooklyn Rail article. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, no problem.
You're just kind of staring at the two of us like, what are you guys on about? You guys are crazy.
He's like, they've totally misunderstood the importance of the burger. Yeah, so in these articles, I think the central kind of conceit of them is replacing the burger with money as universal value, burger time becoming labor time. Mm. How did the burger manifest as the symbol that you want to write these pieces about?
Well, I mean, it manifested in a very just matter-of-fact way where I started to just go outside and say, damn, hamburgers are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to buy just like something cheap while I'm working this shitty job that I also describe in the piece. And as with kind of many things, I started to really think about sort of elaborate this concept of the hamburger. It links to something that I had been writing about, and I had written about inflation a couple of years ago when it kind of the inflationary wave had started. And so it sort of follows up on themes that I had developed in that piece. But yeah, I mean, really, it was just a very matter of fact thing where I think I went to like a McDonald's in, I think this was in the city of Seattle, which is even more expensive. And it was like a total of like $8-something for a single Big Mac, you know, at this McDonald's. And I was like, fuck, that's a lot of money. Like that was really the guttural thing. They started me kind of thinking about it.
We had a mayoral candidate here some years ago, and he caught a lot of flack for being kind of like a one-issue guy, but his thing was the rent was too damn high. Like his retail politics 10, 12 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, was just the rent is too damn high. And he became a meme, but like people actually really did believe it at the same time. They just didn't think he had the means to do it. If you were to do a Trumpian turn and do like a retail political turn like Trump did, perhaps you could just go around telling people the price of burger is way too high and then they would follow you and then you could like become elected and then you could lower the price of burger, I guess, by like increasing the rate of exploitation of burger makers.
Yeah. Is that what you're proposing here? Is that the burger industry cut some labor costs so it can go back to the dollar menu?
Well, I think the dollar menu is you know, a thing of a golden era long past. We'll tell our grandchildren about that.
Well, we still have the dollar menu, but what's increasingly on it is less burgers and more like quesadillas with some cheese melted in it.
Like the crap, like real just, crap, like potatoes with cheese and stuff.
I mean, it's like
hash browns.
Fine, you know, like maybe a dollar burrito at Taco Bell, but it's it's decreasingly like something of sustenance, like a burger, and more just if you need some need to eat something and you only have a dollar,
like starch and carbo, like slop basically. Used to be a glorious day. You used to be able to get an actual cheeseburger right off of that menu. I tell you, the things we're going to be able to tell our grandkids someday. I already tell people that when I first started driving, gas cost 99 cents. And so did a pack of cigarettes. Nobody believes.
Well, but it's down. It's under $3 now, which is really impressive.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so much of the narrative in the first piece is about your life working at a logistics facility, like packing trucks. And then as you're doing this like very difficult work, you're like relating the time that you spend and the calories that you spend to the amount of burgers you can buy, and like the because it seemed like there was nothing else you could possibly eat near you other than McDonald's, right? Is that part of where this idea came from?
Yeah, so I mean, the context is I was working this the night sort at this large kind of somehow, it's called a fully automated facility, but obviously I'm there loading the boxes, so it's not. But they, but it's this giant logistics facility that was outside the port of Tacoma, and it because it was the night shift, there was like basically nothing open. Obviously, it's also like a very sleepy kind of town where things aren't really open ever, unless someone gets just a feeling like they want to open their store. So the only place that you could get food like before or after was going to be, you know, something like McDonald's, or maybe one of the bars would still be open. And so it was, again, this kind of very matter of fact kind of reality of like, oh, if I go and buy food, like if I want to get food, you know, before or after I work, how much of my salary that I'm going to be making that night is that going to deduct, right? That normal kind of working class calculus that I think everyone does when they, you know, go on their lunch break and they're really hungry and then they go to a restaurant. They're like, oh, not this restaurant, because that I'd lose 2 hours, you know, whereas this restaurant I lose 1 hour, you know. So it was a very concrete just a very concrete thing. Now, like you kind of pointed out, you know, is the question making burgers cheaper, et cetera, et cetera. And the burger really represents this much larger crisis, right, which is being represented to us as this cost of living crisis. So it's not just the cost of the burger. It's also, yeah, the rent is too damn high. Used cars cost as much as new cars used to cost, you know? If you want to buy like a 10-year-old car, that basically costs the same as I could buy, like literally, I have a used car bought like a couple years ago. I paid the same amount for that car. It's 10 years old. It's more than 10 years old. It's 14 years old. I paid the same amount that I could have paid for a brand new high quality Chinese EV, if they weren't banned,
which we're not allowed to buy.
Literal cost that they're selling.
Yeah, a $10,000 BYD electric vehicle, all like soup to nuts, like all mod cons, impossible for us to buy because we have to protect our domestic auto industry, you know?
Yeah, and part of this was also I had just been when I was writing this, so I'd worked that job. I quit for basically because my truck, I had a little Ford Ranger, great truck, but people kept thinking they could steal it. And so they would keep smashing the windows and breaking the steering column, trying to steal it, but then they couldn't steal it. So I just kept having to pay out my insurance like every month. And then I couldn't get to work. So then I quit that job. And then I went to China for some other stuff, for some contacts with freelancing and just some travel things. And then I got the opposite experience, right? Where everything was extremely affordable. There were all these like nice little like EV things, little EV scooters and stuff going all around. All the taxis and stuff were these new cheap EVs that are inaccessible to us because of all these kind of tariffs.
And the infrastructure is very, very new, right? The infrastructure is very new. And if it seems as though there's a sort of like social dynamism over there and an optimism, certainly, that we lack.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense. And I was out in like Guiyang for a while, and it's like this city in the interior in Guizhou, which used to be the poorest province, still is technically very, very poor, but had this huge, huge surge of infrastructural development, like just enormous, enormous infrastructural development in this area that had been like really, really poor interior mountainous province. That contrast was also just like, I think, drove the point home so much more.
But how are the burgers?
So that's a good question. I would say they are better.
Oh,
but
better! Wow.
Well,
that's,
I mean,
how
it's
you
not
really,
really
break American imperialism.
We really, you know, if we've lost the burger if there's a burger gap, we're in big trouble.
Yeah. Well, and it's not, you know, that you're getting an actual hamburger, but it's like the burger equivalents, right? Like it's definitely a place where you can just, and this is
the means of subsistence, right? That's what the burger stands in for, the means of subsistence. Yeah,
exactly. So you can go get like a baozi for very little money, super cheap, very filling, same concept.
Wait, you can't,
some sort of doughy thing filled with meat.
You can't go to a place called like American Restaurant and get and get like a facsimile Big Mac.
Oh, you can do that. You could go to Pizza Hut if you want. And Pizza Hut in China is a fine dining establishment.
Yeah.
Like,
you can like go to steak. Like it used to be.
We got
to
go back.
We must go back. If you want to return American nationalist, RETVRN.
They had the green glass windows.
You have to sit at a Pizza Hut in mountainous China and have one of those pitchers of Coca-Cola and those little red glasses with the stained glass lights above you, sit there with your entire family and feed them on like, I don't know what, $3-$4 or whatever. That's the American dream, still exists in China. That's what Phil's trying to tell us.
But getting back to Seattle, you in the second essay, you go back to something you wrote 10 years ago in 2014, when, sort of looking at the cost of living crisis as it was coming on or in its sort of immediate phase, you look at the way Seattle was trying to adjust to this. And it was the $15 an hour campaign. And including in that was this sort of miniature social democracy, including the election of a Trotskyist council member and like a whole kind of movement around her. And looking back, you sort of contextualize it as this broader progressive process to make sure the workers in Seattle could be fed for the time being, right?
And they could have burger.
So it wasn't dealing with any of the underlying reasons why the burger was becoming more expensive or even why the burger was such a central common denominator in working class life, but just we're gonna give you an extra half burger for your time spent on the job per hour, right?
Yeah. So I had been involved in food, like fast food worker organizing back in the 2010s in Seattle, and then got sort of drawn into the Fight for 15 stuff that was going on because of where I was working. And it was like, I write about it in that piece, and there's a bunch of complexities about it and this conflict between the SEIU and Working Washington types and the workers who were kind of involved, who were kind of, you know, used as representatives for the movement. But then the movement very clearly, like very quickly, it became evident to us as fast food workers that it was more about petitioning particular like electoral support and less about even building out any union infrastructure within fast food places or building some sort of food workers federation in the city. It was mostly just about getting laws passed through local city government that were, in this case, the minimum wage laws. And then the thing that was seen as a victory is at the time we were critical of it. And then I think that the actual historical outcome has kind of borne out our criticism pretty well, because we just said like this 10-year plan that you guys have to get to like $20 an hour is a fucking joke. And turns out it is a fucking joke. It wasn't enough. They, even the conservatives now, had to push through higher minimum wage increases at a faster rate because of how rapidly prices increased, especially the cost of rent in the city.
I remember the fight for 15. You know, this was seen as prototypical of like a new labor movement, right? The kind of subtext to it that all of us were looking at as you were fighting in the Pacific Northwest, as SEIU and other service sector unions were spearheading this, of course, is that, you know, this was organizing low-hanging fruit, as it were, that $15 an hour on like a municipal level would be very positive. But like the sense was that it was a broader movement to raise the federal minimum wage, which never ends up happening, but very much tied into the networks of power, municipal and state power in places like Washington State, like Seattle, like New York City and elsewhere, where municipalities still had the ability to throw some weight around and where there was like a one party state of like Democrats running particular state houses or city halls. As it turns out, the imagining the fight for 15 as part of like a broader unionization movement in the United States was a pipe dream, and that instead we did get a rise in some particular minimum wages in some municipalities and in some states. We got even a rise over the last 10 years in the approval rating of unions, but we haven't seen like the concomitant rise in like a brand new workers movement that was going to sweep away the old sclerotic unions, even the old like Andy Stern SEIU, and be able to organize workers in their millions to actually change the name of the game, even in a social democratic way. But it's interesting to look back 10 years and think about the promises that that held out, as the sort of promise of Bernie Sanders is also rising in the background in 2015 and 2016. Feels like we've moved a long way since then, and a lot of the hopes and dreams of that period are dead in the water.
Yeah, and you you go on in that second essay to extend this criticism of the fight for 15 and the sort of Kashama Sawant moment to the sort of optimism around unions today that like we're building towards a general strike in 2017 or whatever, and you put it in the same kind of carnal terms as the thematic of the essay. You write, "What we call unions today merely wear the flesh of the things they helped kill." And is the critique here essentially that their highest goals, their biggest aspiration is just another chunk of burger per hour?
Yeah, well, that second half of the piece, it elaborates on this in quite a bit more detail, but the basic idea is on one hand, it's a historical point that I think is well established if you read kind of communist socialist critiques of kind of business unionism. And in fact, I would characterize in the fight for 15 thing, and in my original piece on the fight for the 15 thing, I actually point out that Sharma played a fairly good role within the fight for 15 and was more or less on our side in opposition to the SEIU and Working Washington types, and was kind of surprisingly like receptive and present throughout the movement. So it was really more a thing of these established kind of business union kind of practices. And those were very much formed through, right, the defeat of any sort of communist current within the United States. And this happened in several different stages and in different ways. It was a bloody conquest, won in the labor wars of the 1920s. But it was also something that had to be kind of reimposed at various points. And it really reached its peak in the formalization of like our modern labor relations system, which, you know, is encoded in the NLRB and all of that. And in the basic logic of that, right, that really redefines. People don't understand it today because everyone kind of thinks of unions as this way because it's been this way for so long, but it really redefined what a union even was. It turned it into this very administrative entity, a legalistic thing that was just about negotiating with an employer in this very kind of limited bargaining framework. But that's really not what unions are, right, or had been. And that's also very, very clearly how they didn't, like not how they operated for a long time, right? The unions as a form of worker organization were always much, much broader than that historically. And you know, this is also something that I think it's funny when I have Chinese friends who will come over to the U.S., you know, they may even get, you know, be having to come over to the U.S. or to Europe because they've been involved in underground labor organizing in China, right? And so they experience like really fairly active and interesting and antagonistic class struggles in the heart of the world's factory. And they come to the U.S. and they're like, oh yeah, I think I'll get involved with some of the unions here. And then they step into those conference rooms, you know, and they're just like, what the fuck are these things? Like, what, like, how do these people think that they're going to win even the things that they're setting out for themselves when they have predetermined that they can't do anything to win those things? Mm. Like that you can't do any sort of antagonistic industrial actions, right? Mm. And then they're, you know, I've had some of these Chinese labor organizers basically just frame it as like, do Americans not read history? Or do they have some sort of thing wrong with their brain where it's like, doesn't add up about how you would get from A to B, you know, without putting any sort of pressure on the employer whatsoever?
Yeah, and I think we're watching the Burger Reich build its palaces. You know, one of the first things that Trump did was fire somebody from the NLRB. So it's, you know, they can't reach quorum. So functionally right now we have no NLRB. And even when we do, it looks like the Supreme Court is about to strip it of whatever power it has left, if not get rid of it entirely. So we're going to, theoretically, we're going to go back to a place where unions are going to have to fight in that more direct way. And if they don't, we're in a situation where we're going to be back to the Dickensian workhouse begging for more gruel, right? And I think maybe the burger is this modern version of the gruel, but it's one that has this kind of more appetizing or like sexualized image to it, where it's, you know, it's our means of subsistence, but there's also kind of a deep meaning to it, where it's like our way of life is that we can have
burger,
a really good burger, even a cheap one at McDonald's.
Yeah, and that makes it all worth it. I would just add too, like, there are all sorts of historical theses being potentially answered at this moment. And one of the things that communists have been saying for a long time, and Phil, I very much ascribe to your point of view about trade unions as they exist in the United States in terms of what they've become versus what they've been. You know, there's been this sense, and you'd hear this occasionally from communists who say, like, the AFL-CIO labor law has been holding back the working class, that in fact you would see struggles on the scale of like the 19th century or even the 1920s if only this like rotten carcass of the National Labor Relations Act, Taft-Hartley, and the unions that arise out of that were swept away. Well, none of us have the guts or the power to sweep those things away. Some of us work and live inside of these regimes and can somehow carve out lives for ourselves, and it'd be a shame to see them go away. But potentially sometime in the next like 4 to 10 to 15 years or so, we might have that historical proposition be tested. And I think we should be prepared for that, because it is a question, like, without this like this dead carcass of like 20th century labor organizations around, can the working class self-organize itself? Can it become a class for itself again? If that is swept away, I don't know. I honestly don't know. We may have moved past the point. You may have like a Beverly Silver, like forces of labor type situation where like strong unionization rates are like cyclical and geographic and they move across the globe. And China is in a phase right now that's maybe the United States was in the 1950s, and that India in 40 years will be in the phase that China's in right now. And the cycle of capital accumulation and the movement of industrialization will just continue across the globe until the heat death of the universe. I don't know. But it seems like right now we know for a fact that the current trade unions are completely ill-equipped to deal with this particular conjuncture, political and economic. What do you think?
And I think that I think that we have to be a little careful about, so I've heard this narrative obviously as well of kind of like, especially if you're in, I don't know, like IWW circles and these sort of alternative unionisms or going to like Labor Notes conference or whatever. You definitely hear these sort of critiques of the business unions frequently, and they're all right in their details, right? Like all this stuff is kind of annoying. They do hold struggles back. They serve this counterinsurgent function in a lot of places. But I think that the problem is actually deeper than that. I'm always very wary, right, of these narratives that try to portray our, you know, the limits or the prospects of revolutionary organizing or whatever in some other force in the left, right? And if it only it wasn't for that force, then the people would be making the right choices and would be organizing some sort of, you know, true working class subjectivity. I think that there are much deeper structural limits that we haven't properly accounted for and formulated organizational responses to, well beyond the fact that there's this kind of counterinsurgent force in the form of like the soft power of these kind of unions kind of negotiating things. I think we can understand this in a couple different ways. So one of the things that I talk about in the in that older piece about the $15 an hour campaign is basically, and this is the prediction that I draw out in the newer piece and kind of compare and contrast what I was talking about was going to happen and then what did actually happen. And the real thing that stands out as like a correct prediction from that is that back then in 2014 or whatever, I was basically saying, look, this movement to change the municipal minimum wage is kind of one of many, right? And we're going to start to see more internal regional divergence in these wage rates that are linked to positions of individual metropolitan areas within this kind of much more complex flows of global value, right? And so one of the key points is that like Seattle and this whole Pacific Northwestern region is kind of proximate to these new productive hubs in Asia. And that value kind of flowing through that circuit, as well as through these lead firms that are headquartered in places like Silicon Valley and in Seattle and in the tech suburbs outside Seattle. All of that is the real basis for these sort of more advanced minimum wage efforts to take place, these little mini bubbles of social democracy. So basically the prediction I was making was you're going to see greater divergence in the wage rates and access to things like that, even within the US, that you'll never get the national minimum wage increased in the way that they were saying that was the plan. But instead, you will see continued increases in minimum wage and local levels of welfare provision. So for example, in Washington State, you can get on, you know, they effectively have a semi-socialized healthcare system. And that's true of a lot of these kind of wealthier states. But if I go to Tennessee, I can't have that, right? And if I go to Tennessee, I'm going to be working maybe for $7.60 an hour because that's the federal minimum wage, right? But then it also depends where I am in Tennessee.
And I think Tennessee was the place. Wasn't there tornadoes came through a couple of years ago and there's a candle factory and the workers in the candle factory like were trying to leave and they were told to stay at the line and the tornado came through and like wiped out a bunch of the workforce. I believe that was Tennessee. So like, yeah, you're this divergence that you talk about, I think is one that you highlight very well in Hinterlands, right? Hinterland as a book talks about core periphery, but also within the core and also within the periphery. The United States geographically, for example, being part of the core when it comes to the global system, but having its own cores and peripheries. So like Tennessee seems like the model where you're stuck to your assembly line even when the tornado's bearing down on you and you're making $7.25 seems to be the productive model du jour of our burger-loving president. You know, and his burger loving administration, Elon Musk and company. I don't know much about Elon Musk's eating habits, but like given his ketamine habits, I can assume that like he loves a good burger.
Yeah, unclear if he eats anything. I've
never seen him eat anything.
Doesn't listen to music, doesn't watch movies, just posts.
Trump's got that McFish in front of him like at all times. He's like constantly like showering people with burgers in the White House. But Musk, the man's just like, I don't know.
What do you think? How does Musk relate to the burger question?
Yeah, the burger question.
Well, there's a couple different little lines of thought there. There's the one thing of the kind of just what is happening within the U.S. Administrative system right now, what's happening in the U.S. corporate hierarchy right now. But the deeper issue is about kind of these prospects of whether we call it reshoring or reindustrialization, kind of the prospects of U.S. industry, right, which is kind of what kind of what Musk represents within kind of the Trump phenomenon. And on the one hand, a lot of the Musk interventions within the federal administrative infrastructure right now are in part just designed to kind of complete a process that began in the Great Recession. So at the Great Recession, you had all these massive American industrial firms, right? Like General Electric, General Motors, Ford, all these sort of classic, post-war American corporations. They got so over leveraged. They made, a bunch of weird investments and like no one really remembers today, but like GE had this huge capital kind of portfolio investment wing. And all that just went to shit, right?
I remember famously when GM gets bailed out that the GMAC, their financing division, was like substantially larger than their industrial division.
Oh yeah. And that's true for all car companies, basically, after a certain point. And so they, all those companies, right, they nosedive. GM has to get bought, turns into a state-owned enterprise, right? And then gets kind of cycled out of state ownership eventually. But that happens to all of these backbone firms. General Electric never recovers. It fragments into three different companies by the 2020s, right? It sells off its entire remnant manufacturing lines for all of its like white goods and consumer goods to Haier from Qingdao. And they actually operate if you buy like a General Electric washing machine, that's who makes it, but it's still made in the US Kentucky, I think in Kentucky. But they have new plants in Georgia and other places. Right. So this is going on. Behind the scenes it doesn't mean that like all these Chinese companies are taking over, right? Because they aren't the ones who are ascending to the top positions in like the Fortune 500 or whatever. Who is ascending those positions? Well, it's a new cadre of American lead firms. It's the Facebook, Alphabet, Apple, the Fangs, right? So it's this new kind of consortium of lead firms based very loosely around tech. But the one like bastion that they don't quite pierce through, that they can't quite conquer within the American corporate world, is the classic military industrial complex, right? Like Facebook doesn't take over these core functions of old military industrial firms, even while companies like Apple, right, ascend well beyond like Ford and GM and all these traditional manufacturers. So what's really happening with Musk right now is kind of the completion of that project by stripping and putting in kind of loyal followers within all these government agencies. The idea is that a bunch of these newer generation of American tech adjacent firms will now be able to gain entry into that hallowed sanctum of military industrial contracts that have long been dominated by companies like Boeing and Raytheon and these classic, like your classic Huntsville, Alabama Nazi rocket science company, like those companies have been unchallenged for a long time. And now these sort of companies will have at least a foot in the door to compete with them for government contracts. And so you're going to see SpaceX trying to get some of these contracts from that would have been previously gone to Boeing.
Suing Boeing for years. And I think probably they've just been like suing each other for a while to get the contracts. And now they can just cut through that process and they have their hands on the levers.
This is fascinating because like what is Elon Musk but like the personal embodiment? Like he's wearing the character mask of capital like in a way that that MAGA like it self-conceives itself as this movement to save America, to make America great again, which is like Elon Musk makes the transition from finance capital to industrial capital. Like, remember, he makes his bones through PayPal, right? Like a like archetypal sort of financial company. But from there, similar to like as I think this reshoring moment imagines American empire could do, like transitions that the financial wealth he has towards Tesla, towards SpaceX, towards the Boring Company, towards like domestic manufacturing. So in a very real sense, Musk is like one of the capitalists who's like a paragon of like what the American empire is reaching for in this new iteration, which is to give up on the M to M prime phase and to like reconstitute itself back into like an industrial empire, but on a higher plane, on like a multipolar plane, on a great power plane, in an aggressive, assertive economic nationalist plane, use tariffs and whatnot in order to like brute force reindustrialize this country. I don't know. I just thought of that for the first time. Phil, what do you think?
I think that on the one hand, I think that we have to be wary of opposing finance to production in general. Finance. So behind the scenes after the Great Recession, the other thing that was happening is that finance was reconsolidating itself and reinventing itself as well. It was going away from your classic Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac alliance with Bank of America, whatever. And it went to a single apex predator. That's JP Morgan Chase, plus all of these asset management and private equity and VC firms. The asset management ones are the most important, outside of JP Morgan Chase. But then the private equity serves a crucial function, recycling kind of non-profitable aspects. So these financial activities always get portrayed as like, oh, just unproductive kind of financial rents. That's not really how finance works. Finance also enhances the productivity and competitiveness of the entire industrial chain as well. And most of modern industry can't operate without very intricate forms of financial engineering that facilitate the existence of global supply chains. Now, that said, there is this massive unproductive kind of rent being siphoned out. And it's not in finance or whatever. This is basically like a Ricardian socialist point of like the evil unproductive finance versus the real economy. No, in fact, this massive kind of unproductive sink is found in two places. One is just classic kind of reproductive sectors writ large. So understood as like the state, right? An educational sector, and then a bunch of like state spending and whatnot, which are just by definition kind of like not productive activities. They are not for like for profit in the same way. They do not produce value in the same way as intensive industrial production. But the other one is even more classic. It's just fucking landlords. Like, a lot of what gets wrapped into this idea of non-productive rents is just very classic forms of landlordism. And I think everyone understands this at an intuitive level, because if you scroll through like the ruins of Facebook, right? And in between the weird conspiracy theories and the UFO sightings, you get those little like marketed ads, and they're all like get rich quick schemes, right? And half of them are just ways to quote unquote make passive income. And passive income is just being a landlord for something, right? It's just being able to, that you buy a car and you rent it out to someone who does Uber, like, or you buy properties and you rent properties and then you do an Airbnb out of the property that you rent, right? So you're a landlord within a landlord within a landlord. Mm-hmm.
That's sort of like the part of the speculative vulture, like lumping part of the MAGA coalition, right? Is this like passive income seeking, hustle and grind sort of like boomer, let's call it, you know, because there is like a generational component to it too. Sort
but
of
it's
like
also a boomer,
shyster capitalism
alliance in some ways. Mm, mm. You know, the same as like a boomer zoomer alliance of like watching a video on your phone with the volume turned all the way up in a public place. it's similar to that, because a lot of those grind set guys are these kind of young you know, dapper looking Zoomers who are like the good ones, right? Who are very buttoned up and down to business, right? They're the ones who really sell this idea a lot. They're the, you know, here's how I made $1 million before drop I was shipping. 24.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's drop shipping or it's being a fucking landlord. That's all it is.
The lords demand their burgers. They need their burger tithe. That's what we get from your two articles here.
Yeah. How far off are we from the fast food chains consolidating and making a BMAC that financializes burgers so you can you can have one today and pay for it Tuesday in the classic Popeye schema?
You can already
schema.
Do that. You can yeah, already, yeah, you do, can that, already right? do that.
There's an app for that? There's a burger app?
There is an app for that. You can finance almost any kind of micro purchase now into, you know, little digestible bits. But I want to get back to this idea of Musk and the kind of role of industry kind of in this. Because on the one hand, yeah, all the MAGA people, like there's this very important lumpen bourgeois portion of the MAGA coalition that can't give up that landlordist impulse, right? That's a very important part of it. And that's going to draw down the returns kind of regardless. Because their landlords are just parasites. They don't do anything, right? Even classic capitalist like political economy says this, right? They fucking hate landlords too, because they're just like, yeah, they really don't do anything. Now, on the other side, though, there is this question about reindustrialization, reshoring, and whatnot. And I think that this question actually gets us to some of those structural problems I was mentioning a little while ago. So I'll tell a story to kind of illustrate the basic problem. This, I think Trump himself, to understand the story, we have to understand that Trump himself is very, very good at these strange, mythic ceremonial operations within American culture. So the thing that you guys opened with, the burger thing, right? He works at McDonald's and then suddenly his ratings kind of tip up. The assassination attempt also kind of helps with this, right? But the burger thing is like this very, very strange and very intelligent and intuitive thing that Trump is able to do, where he can tap these main lines in the American mythos. So he's basically, what he's doing with that is he's making this strange ritual performance to the burger god, which of course rules America. And by doing that, by showing fealty to the proper deity of the American kind of mythological structure, he actually does get this massive return within the American population, right? So there's an earlier period that he also does this. And this is kind of the focus of the little story. If you look back, not quite 10 years ago, but not that much less than 10 years ago, I think it's like 7 or 8 years ago, there's this video, you can still find it on YouTube, and it's Trump and the governor of California, and I think the House Speaker or some other Republican functionary, and then there's this guy, there's this random guy who's a representative of the working man, right? And they're all holding these golden shovels, and behind them, like these columns in like this vaulted chamber are two excavators, the arms of two excavators, and they're elevated and they have this giant American flag hanging down. And they're just standing in this field of dirt. And then they all collectively, you know, punch these golden shovels into the dust, right? And this is the plains of the Midwest, so it's a very American kind of space. And then they wave for the cameras, you know, and then they walk off. And this ceremony, this ritual, right? It's ostensibly on the surface, it's the ritual to break ground on the Foxconn plant in Wisconsin, which is going to employ 10,000 to 30,000 Americans at a single LCD factory.
And now it's like just a ghost town with a geodesic dome in the middle of it and a bunch of broken AI golf carts.
It's one of those actual ghost cities, which they accuse China of having.
Well, and what this functions as in this kind of mythic sense is this attempt to draw back the great god development, right, from its westward arc, to draw it back to its old temple in the grains, right, mm-hmm. where it once inhabited this Midwestern core of the planetary factory, not that far from there, you know? It's this very interesting kind of global performance of like, we're going to get the modern representative of the global factory, Foxconn, and they're going to come back here and they're going to make these jobs. And then like we talked about last episode, it didn't work, right? But but also what did get put there ultimately. Okay, the geodesic dome and the abandoned things, but the final result was that Microsoft bought it and put a data center there, right? And most of the jobs were construction workers who built the data center. And then they finish it and they go home. And then there's like five guys.
Two or three guys center. Who keep the lights on or off, as the case may be, in the data center.
Exactly.
This is like, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go on, continue.
Oh, I would just say this is the structural problem. This is the deeper kind of structural thing that really casts a lot of doubt on, are you going to bring back manufacturing? And if you do, is it going to actually employ anybody? Right?
Right.
Because you look at the same thing, you could say, okay, yeah, Biden did the CHIPS Act and stuff. But what really benefited from the CHIPS Act? It was battery plants and semiconductor plants, right? Those are the big ones that actually did break ground and started to be built. And then also data centers. But none of those places employ that many people, except for some construction workers at the very beginning, right? And so it's kind of the more of the same.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, reading your work, reading these two essays, then of course Hinterlands as well, you can see why you have a certain superpower, which is that like you've read Marx, but you also work, which anymore is like a superpower to have. It's one I think Andy and I share as well. But like you can really feel in your writing, and you evoke the burger, of course, in this as sort of this molecular, atomistic, like means of survival, like commodity, you know, that explains much more than that. But you can really see in your writing and in your speaking the reasons for why Marx felt the need to like fall back upon anthropology, this conception of fetishism. There is something obscure and arcane about capitalist production. There is a way in which, as you say, Trump is popular and powerful because he's able to like intuitively pick up on these bizarre rituals necessary, these ways of expressing meaning necessary in order for the system to legitimize itself and revolutionize itself over and over and over again. And he stands as this archetypal transition figure between like the 20th century and the 21st century. I think in a very real sense, the 21st century is only maybe just begun now. You know, we're facing something new. And I think your writing really helps with that, but I'm not sure that like reading your piece, I think there's a reason why Will Stancil or Steven Pinker can look at GDP numbers in the United States, or they can look at the statistics and say we live in the best of all possible worlds, when it really takes like a Marxist who works in a warehouse, who drives past the homeless encampments, who understands the breakdown between like wages and burger and like sustenance and calories, to actually understand this system in a way that all the technocrats who are being thrown out of USAID and the Treasury Department maybe had no way of understanding. Like maybe the future belongs to Musk and Trump in a way, but maybe it also belongs to like Marxists who were able to get their vision to understand this moment in time in all of its chaos and all of its logic. There's a deep logic to what's happening right now, too.
Maybe something to add to that is, like, as we're trying to kind of parse out what the contradictions are within this increasingly all-powerful Trump coalition, one early thing that came up was this burger beef between Kennedy Jr. and Trump, where Kennedy, of course, has this sort of new age raw milk, egg and meat, like raw meat, you know, dietary weirdness to him, whereas Trump is like, you know, stop being a pussy, just eat the burger. And I think there is sort of a sort of romantic aspect to Kennedy's new age anti-vax weirdness, whereas as Trump is more, he's more just like the guarantor of letting the pink slime continue to flow. And in sort of both of those, the tension is over like this whatever Volkish concept of how we're going to feed and sustain and nourish the American people. Are they going to eat something healthier, organic, or are they going to just continue to have a, you know, this trough of fast
pink
food
slime
slop to subsist, yeah, on?
Right. The dollar menu, like cheesy potatoes or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And power is ultimately rooted, right, in these kind of very, very rudimentary forms of subsistence. And so that's true for both left-wing kind of oppositional forces, right? They have to be addressing subsistence as well, but they can't get trapped within subsistence issues. But it's also true for these kind of right-wing kind of reorientations of power, right? They have to promise some sort of reinvention of those, that kind of basic embodied reality of people, right? Because everybody, I mean, I don't think it's at this intuitive sense, right? You can look at the numbers and you can say, oh, okay, well, we're doing good and on GDP and life expectancy is pretty good. But then as soon as you start to disaggregate them at all, you realize the lies, right? You're like, oh, wait, why is maternal mortality so fucking high? You know, why is when we disaggregate this by income, you know, why does this part of the U.S. actually, is it actually more comparable to like a, you know, a lower middle income country than to a high income country on all of these registers, from mortality, morbidity, to just like raw income and what people have in their houses? Or, you know, like, why are there entire neighborhoods that are still like unelectrified, right, in these suburbs and in places in New Mexico? Like, there's these massive, massive disparities. But at the same time, we all also get this intuitive sense. And this is, again, yeah, what you're saying, like, Trump plays on these kind of mythic elements. But the mythic elements, they do link to this fundamental kind of, if you want to call it like collective unconscious or whatever. And RFK Jr. does too, right? One of the kind of historical analogies are always dangerous, but one of the ones that you can make that I think is very useful in this moment is if you look at like the late Qing Dynasty. And during the late Qing Dynasty, right, you have this massive opioid crisis. You have this huge declines in basic like health metrics, basic livelihood metrics. You have this kind of sequence of just corrupt, inept, or like insane imperial kind of courts, right? These senile viziers and these mad emperors and all of that, which is kind of our, you know, condition today. And then you also have these rejuvenation movements. And the rejuvenation movements span this very, very intelligent and kind of forward-thinking kind of industrial side of trying to, like, let's do the Meiji Revolution here, et cetera, et cetera. But then they also span all the way over into this crazy conspiratorial, weird, neo-traditionalist.
This would be the Boxer Rebellion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. During the Boxer Rebellion, you have these guys who are drinking, you know, drinking kind of melted silver and then thinking that they're going to be bulletproof and trying to fist fight a bunch of guys with guns, right? And they get slaughtered by this imperialist army that's sent in to quell them from all the Western powers kind of united. But all the Western powers had to unite to defeat them. It was a substantial uprising, right? And it also kind of set the stage for actual kind of revolutionary, more like left-leaning revolutionary forces to emerge, you know, farther down the road. And when you look at someone like RFK Jr., it's very much Boxer Rebellion vibes, right? Because what he's saying, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. Because the thing is, if you go, like if I was to drive out of Tacoma up into downtown Seattle and buy some food, right, I could find some really nice organic salad type thing with some complicated name, and it would be really good for me, and I could resource it. I could tell where all the sourcing was done, and it would cost, you know, $50 or something. But I could, you know, I could get this kind of nice food, and there's a good health department and all that stuff, right? So a lot of liberals of that type who are buying that stuff look at the things that like RFK Jr. is saying, and they're like, oh, this guy's crazy. He's just crazy, right? But then everybody else in all these other places who are eating like things that are just literally poison and are seeing themselves and their family members being poisoned and like have all these chronic pain issues and these illnesses that just keep recurring and recurring and recurring, and they're getting strange deformities, and they have all these other like mental health things that crop up for all these other different reasons, you know? And RFK Jr. suddenly is on, you know, these in these highest echelons of kind of media attention, and he's describing the format of every RFK Jr. like speech and things is a really fascinating kind of bait and switch type thing, because the first half he actually just describes literal well documented public health problems that have been the topic actually mostly of far left public health like activists for many, many years.
He was and far then, left, you know, maybe 15, yeah, 20 yeah. years ago.
And so he describes all this stuff. He's like, well, why is maternal mortality among Black women so high? And you're like, oh, yeah, why? You know? And then he launches into the most batshit explanation for why that is. You know, it's all this, your classic conspiratorial, well, it's because the government is feeding us these like metal things inside the food, and that metal is going into our blood, and that, you know, it's just like this very, very strange form of prose, right? Because he kind of hooks a bunch, but you can see how it hooks a bunch of people. The haters if you won't be. Hey. Now that's a
burger for your ass, like the onion. Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Fucking London cracker children wanted something, they could bump and punch a bunch of fucking face stump them out. Washing pistol breaking arms, zombie circus not a car, and evil wolves is on the farm, and we're all evil harmed. Any sheep creep quiet in their sleep, make a peep, fucking body will go missing in a week, roam around the city with her titties like a fucking